Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
This fall, fall in love with Cozy. Nothing says autumn like wrapping up in the rich, warm colors of Minky Couture. From golden ambers to deep burgundy and rustic browns, Minky blankets bring the beauty of the season right into your home. Perfect for crisp evenings, family time, or gifting someone special. Fall in love with Minky and shop your favorite fall colors today at minkycouture.com.
Because you know Julie Mugford, you know Jerry Bamber's girlfriend, stroke fiancé, you know the one who went on the windsurfing break after the funerals and then went to Amsterdam to score weed after the little boy's funerals. Yeah, she isn't a happy puppy. And she ends up on that date going and speaking to the police. And she says, you know what? I haven't been honest with you. I need to give you an honest statement. And there is pickup. An honest statement? You've been lying to us about something so serious? 5 people have been murdered. And you're now telling us that your statement wasn't true? So then she really starts to unravel and she starts to tell her side of the story.
I'm Emma Kenny. Welcome to Bang to Rights, the deep dive crime podcast, which takes you through some of the most heinous crimes the world has ever seen.
So first of all, she starts talking about how Jeremy Bamber really feels about his family. She said that he disliked them, he particularly didn't get along with his sister Sheila, and that he absolutely resented his parents. He said that those parents tried to ruin his life and run his life. He also described Sheila and his mother as mad, and said that his father was getting old, and he also said apparently that the twins were emotionally disturbed and unbalanced because of the way that they were raised. She then said that Jeremy Bamber had spoken about killing his family, and that the conversations about killing his family had just increased and increased in frequency around October 1984. Apparently he'd said that he wished he could get rid of them, and that if he was going to get rid of them, it would be all of them, referring to his sister and her 2 children. He initially apparently talked about drugging his family after a meal and then going so far as to set the house alight and burning them all to death alive. But apparently the reason he hadn't gone ahead with that plan is he did not want to destroy the valuable things inside, because indeed there were very valuable things inside. So he eventually confided in Julie that he'd come to the conclusion the best way to manage the situation and to get rid of them was to shoot them all instead. And he said, basically, Sheila's going to be the perfect fall guy. She'll be a believable scapegoat. She's had all these struggles with her mental health. So if I put her as the antagonist in the situation, the reality is that no one's going to question it. So he said he's going to stage the scene as this murder-suicide that his sister has committed. Julie also said that the way he'd managed to do this was he was going to use a faulty kitchen window. This meant that he could go in, get in without people knowing, and it not look like anybody had broken into the home. Apparently this window was able to be latched shut from the outside, so that would mean that Jeremy could have left through that window and then latched it shut once he was outside the house. She even went on to say that at 9:50 p.m. on the 6th of August, Jeremy Bamber had actually called her. During that call, he'd said that he'd been thinking about the plan all day to kill his family, so he was obsessing about it, and he said he was pissed off and it was tonight or never. Then he calls her a few hours later, somewhere between 3 and 3:30 a.m. on the 7th, and he said, everything's going well, something's wrong at the farm, I haven't had any sleep all night, bye honey, and I love you lots. Now that's a direct quote, doesn't make sense to me. Everything's going well, something's wrong at the farm, I haven't had any sleep all night, bye honey, I love you lots. There is nothing really descriptive and it doesn't kind of have any flow to that statement, but nonetheless, this is what she told the police. Now he phones her again in the morning. At that point, he tells her a police car's going to come and pick her up, tells her that she shouldn't go to work. And he said that Sheila had gone mad, which is strange with respect, because again, just to question a little bit about this statement. If he's told her that he's going to kill his family and she knows all of this direct info and intel, why would he then say that Sheila had gone mad? Because understandably, she's in on what's happening. She's aware of the fact that he's going to go ahead and kill them, or he's going to be involved in the killing. So why would he now need to talk about Sheila having gone mad? Now, when Jeremy actually saw Julie, then apparently he said that he should have been an actor. So he's implying that he put on a really good performance for the authorities. Julie also said in a statement to the police that she'd asked Jeremy if he was the one responsible for the deaths. And at this point, apparently, he said to her that he didn't kill the family himself. Instead, he'd actually paid one of his friends, Matthew McDonald, £2,000 to murder them. He'd asked McDonald to actually phone him whilst he was inside the farm doing the killings. So that essentially there'd be a record of him being on the phone at his home at the time of the murders. That was his alibi. That would mean he wouldn't be implicated himself. Julie also went on to say that McDonald had told him that there'd been this really violent altercation with Jeremy's father, Neville, which fits in with how Neville's body was found. And McDonald had said that for an old man, he was very strong and had put up a fight. Also, he told Jeremy Bamber that the twins hadn't felt anything. They'd been killed in their sleep. Sheila had allegedly been the last person to be killed. He'd actually told her to lie down on her back and to shoot herself, which apparently she'd done. And then he'd put a Bible on her chest. I don't know if I'm missing something here, but are we expected to believe that McDonald handed a loaded rifle to a woman who just had her children murdered and her parents murdered, and she was like, okay, I'll just do it. Like, I'm just going to throw it out there as a mother, as an individual who has parents as well, or at least still has one. If you killed them, and I knew you killed them, and then you handed me a loaded gun and said, kill yourself, I tell you what, I would kill something, but it wouldn't be me, you know? And at close range, with a loaded gun, if you are an intruder in my home, I'm going to be pulling the trigger in your direction. I'm not going to be like, okay then, I'll do it. Oh, I'm going to do it twice. Just doesn't make sense to me at all. But this is apparently what Julie tells the police. Surely she'd have used the weapon. Surely she would have killed the guy who had killed the people that she loved. Then Julie went on to tell the police that apparently Jeremy Bamber was really happy all the time. After the funerals in particular, he was really happy. He was spending loads of money. He was buying really expensive things for the both of them. They were eating out. They were staying at hotels. They were going on weekend breaks. And then Julie said that on the August the 31st, she'd had a conversation with Jeremy Bamber. And she actually said to him, do you love me? And at this point, he said to her, I don't know. She said that she told him at that point that she felt really guilty because she knew about the murders and that she'd been put in a really precarious situation. She was aware of what had happened and she hadn't spoken to the police about it. She said that she was really struggling to cope with him just acting so normal after what he'd done, and that this was something that really started to manifest in her mind. Then, on September the 3rd, Jeremy allegedly took a call from an ex-girlfriend of this. And during this call, Julie heard him ask this ex-girlfriend out, which understandably caused an argument. We can all completely feel sorry for Julie if that actually happened, because you would hate somebody that you love to be asking another person out when you're in a relationship with them. And she actually apparently threw an ornament box, which then hit a mirror, and she also slapped Jeremy. He then allegedly twisted her arm behind her back in a rage, and it took about 4 days after that for her to go to the police. I do struggle a little bit with the legitimacy of this statement again. I'm not saying it didn't happen. I'm saying I struggle in exploring this because of the fact that if you want to take into account Julie being truthful, well, she was quite happy to have all the money spent on her. She was quite happy to gallivant with him when he was apparently happy, or to drown his sorrows when he was apparently sad. She was quite happy to do anything that benefited her on every single level until she thought it was into somebody else and potentially he didn't love her. And then, wow, having that information that this guy that she's hanging out with is a mass murderer, then it pricked her conscience. That's really strange. Either way, she went to the police for the wrong reasons. It was self-motivated. It wasn't about guilt, it was about vengeance. It's as simple as that. No matter which way you cut it, it's about vengeance. She was comfortable with the killings until she felt uncomfortable with his relationship towards her. So she was motivated by jealousy. And I genuinely think if he'd reassured her at that point and wasn't making dates with an ex, she would have probably carried on quite happily. At the end of the day, it sounds a little bit like, if I was just playing devil's advocate, her accusations could be seen as false because they could just be lies made up by a bitter ex-girlfriend. Now, I'm not saying that's true. I'm just saying, if I was the defence, that's certainly the way that I would cut it. Now, after Julia has spoken to the police, understandably, they have to go and arrest Jeremy, and he's staying at Sheila's former apartment. So early the following morning, Detective Jones pounds on the door and Bamber opens it. When he's told that he's being arrested on suspicion of murdering his mother, father, sister, and two children, apparently Bamber just looked at him in disbelief and said, "I don't believe what I'm hearing." He said, "It must be something else you want me for, not murder." So he really couldn't compute. He acted totally blindsided, totally shocked. Matthew McDonald, he's also arrested because he's been implicated. McDonald's like, "What?" Like, literally, totally blindsided because he said, "I have had nothing to do with this. I know nothing about this. It doesn't make any sense to me." And he provided an alibi for the night of the murders. Also, it was found it was absolutely 100% not possible for him to have been at the farm when they tracked his movements. Also, that £2,000 it was apparently paid, yeah, it was never traced. So there was no reality that he'd been paid any money whatsoever. So it was very clear that McDonald had nothing to do with the murders. So what Julie said was BS, at least that part. I mean, she literally implicated McDonald. She came up with a whole theory about how McDonald helped, the amount of money, and so on and so forth. Why would Bamber be saying that to her? It's confusing. But even though he's completely exonerated, they absolutely take it seriously that Jeremy Bamber was responsible for the murders. Now, he's maintaining his innocence. In fact, with respect, he's maintained his innocence throughout his incarceration as well. So he basically says, "Listen, this is about a woman spiting me. This is about somebody who doesn't like me anymore because I've ended the relationship, or she's ended the relationship. We've come to a point in our life where we don't want to be together because I've asked somebody else out," and so on and so forth. "She's angry with me. And as they say, health have no fury like a woman scorned," which basically, when you translate it, means that women can be more furious than the devil. I think we can. I think very justified at times. But nonetheless, on this occasion, she has a right to be annoyed, but it is really unfair if she's gone into the police to implicate him when she's actually made it up. I'm not saying she has. I'm saying there's a possibility that she has when you draw down, as I've said, the actual disparity in her statement versus what the police are able to find. Now, apparently, even with that new information, Detective Taft Jones felt that Jeremy Bamber was innocent. But during his conversations with the police, he did make two important admissions. So the first one is when he was asked if there was a way to get into the White House farm when it was locked, he said, "Yep, I know since childhood exactly how to get in. I could jimmy the windows." And he also said that he did carry out a theft at the Osier Road Vacation Park. Now, bear in mind, his parents had a business interest in that, and the Bellflowers also did. And around £1,000 was stolen, and it turned out that it was him and Julie, that credible, believable source who's just so innocent in all of this. Yeah, she'd helped steal the money. And he said, "I knew I'd be the number one suspect," but he knew that they couldn't prove it. So he's kind of shown himself to be deceptive around his family, but he's also brought into sharp focus the fact that he was not alone and his girlfriend was quite happy again to go and be completely immoral by stealing. Now, after holding Jeremy Bamber for 5 days, the police genuinely were forced to concede that they had nothing concrete that connected him to the killings. So at this point, he's charged with burglary, he's released on bail, and he gets tailed by plainclothes detectives because they want to check out exactly what his movements are. He could be a flight risk if they realise that actually there is something they can get him on regarding the murders. And they know on the day that he's actually released, he goes out first to a wine bar, then he goes to an upscale strip club called Stringfellows. It's a very popular gentleman's club in the UK, and it has a lot of, shall we say, scantily clad and non-clad women dancing. So he went there, but again, it costs quite a lot of money, you know, if you want to be entertained there. So again, he is flashing the cash, shall we say. Now, at this point in the case, Detective Superintendent Mike Ainsley takes over the investigation. So he is more cynical about Jeremy Bamber, and he actually requests Bowflower's notes on the case. And when he reads the family's notes on the case, he gets more and more convinced of Bamber's guilt. I do have a bit of an issue with this because, you know, if the family have got a vested interest in Jeremy Bamber going to prison, particularly financial vested interest, then they're going to have a skewed idea and bias about how the crime played out. And it feels from the very get-go, they've decided that Jeremy Bamber is absolutely 100% guilty. Therefore, the notes that have been made probably play into that bias. Now, officers on the scene of the night of the murders, they, of course, as I've said that some of Bamber's behaviour was strange. So one of the big things that they struggled with is when he called the police, he didn't call 999. He'd actually looked at the local police station. So that concerned them. And when the police saw Jeremy Bamber's car, they actually passed it. And they passed that car on the way to White House Farm. They said that he looked like he was driving suspiciously slow. To some degree, though, police cars do drive very fast, so you driving at a normal speed might be considered slow when they're whizzing past you. Some said there was an odd calmness during the siege, but I've talked about that earlier on. Others said that he was weeping constantly, but that they felt it was false. But again, many people who saw him didn't feel that way. The officer who actually took him home, they said that he wasn't showing any signs of real emotion. And like I said, he made himself a cup of coffee and a bacon sandwich. And all of this starts to really concern Detective Ainsley. So then he goes and sends a report to the Director of Public Prosecutions. And he described in that Bamber as a calculated killer who had murdered his family for the vast wealth he stood to gain. He did stand to gain quite a lot of money, without a doubt, you know, probably £500,000, which is a hell of a lot of money back at that time, probably the equivalent of about £3 million now. So that is a large amount of money. And this is at a point where Jeremy Bamber is using that money to some degree to good purpose. He's traveling. So he's off to Saint-Tropez. That was in the late September when he comes back from Saint-Tropez, that he doesn't get the reception he probably wanted, which was to probably carry on enjoying himself. Instead, he's arrested in the customs hall at Dover. The following day, he's arraigned on 5 murder charges. He's held without bail. And as he's actually driven away to Norwich Prison, he basically saw a group of his friends who kind of saw him going through this, and he smiled at them. Now, that picture, that photograph, if anybody knows this case, you'll have seen it. And it feels so out of context. It sounds so wrong that when a person is being arrested by the police and removed from a particular situation, charged potentially with 5 murders, that they would have any kind of smile capacity. But again, he probably isn't computing what's happening. He probably doesn't feel he's got anything to answer. He sees his friend and he's like smiling because it's like, oh, you know, no case to answer here, but gonna have to go through the motions of this situation. So that could also, in spite of it becoming a notorious image of the crime, be an explanation for that notorious image. Now, in October 1986, a trial takes place. The jury, they actually get informed at that point that the murders had either been committed by Sheila Cafell or Jeremy Bamber. So that means that rather than just have to find Jeremy Bamber innocent or guilty, essentially, in order to read their verdict, they have to decide whether they thought Jeremy or Sheila was responsible. So basically, finding Jeremy not guilty would have to mean that they thought Sheila was guilty. Now, that's not typical for a trial. It really isn't typical for a trial. But that was the mindset they had to enter that situation with. Now, Jeremy's defense, that was led by QC Jeffrey Rivlin. Now, He argued that Sheila had likely been having a psychotic episode and it would be during this psychotic episode that she'd have shot her family. But then he argued, because the silencer is the issue, bear in mind, at this moment in time, he argued that she'd taken the silencer, put it back in the cupboard, changed her clothes, cleaned her hands, and then killed herself. And the reason for that is he's bringing in this idea of ritualistic behaviour. Now, ritualistic behaviour does happen when people carry out altruistic killings. So if somebody believes that they're doing the best in a certain situation, they'll often have this kind of ritualistic behaviour. She also had this history of psychiatric illness. She'd spoken about having really disturbed morbid thoughts about violence. And the way he explained the blood on the silencer, so it was the defence's case, that the blood was actually a combination of Neville and June's, not Sheila's. And there was actually a possibility that that was the case. But the previous expert had said that the most likely scenario was that the blood belonged to Sheila. They did accept that the blood being a mixture of her parents was a remote possibility, but they'd kind of gone for it being more likely to be hers. Also, one of the things that Jeremy Bamber wanted to have said in court, but it didn't get to court because his defence felt like it was too far-fetched to say, he felt that the actual blood had been planted by the wider family. So Sheila had been on a period, her undergarments were in the kitchen covered in blood in a bucket, and he felt they had access to that blood. But like I said, the defence just thought this will seem really far-fetched and could cause us more problems than it could do us good. Now the prosecution, on the other hand, they said after he'd been working on the farm on the day of the murders, Jeremy had basically used the rifle to shoot rabbits, left the weapon out on the table before going home. They then said he cycled around 3 miles back to the farm. He took the quieter roads because he didn't want to be seen, because there were no witnesses who did see him. And once he got back to the farm, he climbed through the bathroom window. Once he got inside, he got the rifle, went upstairs when the family were in the beds asleep. Then after he killed them, he arranged the bedroom to give the impression that Sheila had killed herself and was responsible for the rest of the murders. And then before cycling back home, he'd put the silencer away and called his home from the kitchen phone, leaving it off the hook. He had then left via the kitchen window, which he was then able to latch close once outside by banging the window so that it fell into place and then locked from the inside. And it said that the whole mindset behind the killings was very simple. It was financial gain. He'd received £435,000 after their death. So their estate included the home. They also jointly owned other farming properties, including Osier Road caravan site. Also, the prosecution called into question the phone call that Jeremy said he received from his dad on the night of the murders. They said, listen, the injuries that Neville received to his jaw meant that he would not have been able to speak. Also, there was no blood on the kitchen phone. But we could also say, yeah, but that injury to the jaw could have been inflicted after he made a phone call. So it was suggested then by the prosecution, well, no, Neville would have called the police rather than his son. Now, we know that that isn't always the case, actually. We know in situations and circumstances, we often call people we love before we call the emergency services, particularly if we can't believe that something's playing out, particularly if we think that they can come and help us. Also, if Jeremy received the call, their argument was he should have called 999 immediately, whereas he actually phoned Julie first. Then he called the police station. So he called his girlfriend first, the police station second, and he didn't use the 999 call. He didn't use the emergency. But Jeremy Bamber said, yes, I didn't, because I was so used to my sister having mental health issues and my father can usually handle these situations. I didn't realise how serious the situation was at first. I just thought I'll call the local constabulary. It'll be fine. Now, Dr. Ferguson. So this is a consultant psychiatrist who treated Sheila. So he then testified as an expert. And he said that Sheila, having murdered her family and then killing herself, quote, did not fit his concept of his patient. So he didn't believe that she would be violent, particularly towards her children or her father. He said that he saw her father as a very trusted, safe person, someone who was secure, someone who was caring, and that she really loved and cared for her children. Now, he did say that she had some disturbed feelings towards her mother and also described Sheila as a highly disturbed woman. So the language there is that we have somebody who's highly disturbed. Let's just be real about that. The assumptions that that person who's highly disturbed won't harm people because she loves them would mean that she wasn't highly disturbed. When you're highly disturbed, it means you're not rational and things don't make sense that would usually make sense to a typically thinking person. Now, he found it possible that she might have wanted to harm her mother or indeed herself, but he said that she never had any violent outbursts when she was in hospital, even when she was in a very disturbed state. But she did in hospital describe that she had suicidal thoughts, but nonetheless, he didn't believe that she was a suicide risk. Now, I don't know whether Dr. Ferguson is psychic, but I think there's a lot of his own ideas around what he wants to be reality versus what seems to be reality. Because we can talk about who she'll direct anger at, who she'd want to hurt or wouldn't want to hurt, but I think we have to stick with what we know, which is that she'd expressed suicidal thoughts and was highly disturbed and also had big issues with her mother and was often in agitated states in these circumstances. So you can't, with typical thinking, imagine atypical reality. When you're in atypical reality, you act in an atypical way. I'm just saying because I find it quite strange that it's so clearly stated that because she loved her father, she wouldn't harm him. People harm people because in that moment, they're not computing the relationship. They're in a delusional state. Then, of course, they bring in Julie because Julie's obviously told the police that she knows exactly what's happened, that Jeremy Bamber is guilty. So she repeats what she told the police. She said that he confessed to her. He was responsible for the death of his family. Now, during that testimony, she did have to admit that she had, shall we say, had some dalliances with criminal activity. You had, hadn't you, Julie? You hadn't exactly been a good girl. So she basically had told the police in the interview that she had done some criminal acts. Those crimes included fraud. So she'd used a friend's checkbook to buy £700 worth of goods. She made a false report that the checkbook had been stolen. And then she and her friend had basically gone back later to the bank and confessed. And then they'd repaid the money that they'd stolen, which is a little bit strange, but we'll come to that afterwards. They'd received at this point a police caution, but the bank didn't press any charges because the money had been repaid. She also said that in 1985, at the Easter time, she'd stolen the money with Jeremy from the offices of the Osea Road caravan site. That was, as I said, owned by Jeremy and his family. They'd taken between £970 and £980. Jeremy had made the scene look like someone had broken in and stolen the money, which is awful and a terrible testament to Jeremy's behaviour, without a doubt. The judge actually later commented in his summary that it's the defendant's, Jeremy's case, of course, that Julie Mugford's evidence in this case is fabricated and that she is a brazen, blatant liar. So the matter of her previous check offences were introduced in order to suggest to you then that it was shown that she has been dishonest in the past so that you can bear in mind that part of her character when assessing whether to believe her. But he also said, of course, the fact that a person has committed some offence or has at some time lied in the past in no way proves that they can never again tell the truth. He also said that they needed to bear in mind that she had volunteered her fraud to the bank and paid back the money, despite the probability that she would never have been caught, which does seem strange, but we'll come to that later on. Now, Robert Boutflower, that's June's brother-in-law, he also testified. And he said that in the past, he had literally heard Jeremy say, I could kill anyone. I could kill easily my parents. So that's pretty horrible, isn't it? Don't get me wrong. A lot of us say horrible things at certain points. Sometimes on this channel, I talk about liquidizing child abusers. I know it's not very nice, but at the end of the day, I haven't been out liquidizing any child molesters. I just sometimes think that in my head, that's how I cope. Not doing it, just thinking of doing it. So we can't say that just because Jeremy Bamber is saying I could kill anybody, I could easily kill my parents, that he would actually go ahead and do it. But again, doesn't look good in court. Jeremy, of course, said, I never said that at all. I never told anybody I wanted to kill my parents. And it's important to note that when he inherited the money and estate of his parents, Jeremy Bamber wanted to sell the estate that he owned. Now, the Boutflowers did not want that. Neville had actually bought land previously owned by the Boutflower Eaton family, with the whole premise that he was going to sell this to Anne Eaton when she could afford it. So this changes everything. So in a police review, it's actually written that the conviction of Jeremy Bamber is likely to result in material benefit to the Boutflower family. Now, the jury were actually aware of this because they asked a question at trial, which was, if Jeremy Bamber was found guilty and in prison for many years, who would be the beneficiaries of the Bamber estate and monies? Could it be his uncle and family? Because again, they're the ones who created this pen portrait of possibility about his guilt, and they want to know, would they be the ones who inherit?
And Mr. Monopoly here. Monopoly is back at McDonald's. Register in the McDonald's app so you're ready to
get your bag.
Two ways to peel for a chance to
get your bag.
Physical peels with select items and digital peels with others to
get your bag.
Play Monopoly at McDonald's.
Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
No purchase necessary. See rules at playatmcd.com for full details and amoe.playatmcd.com to play without purchase. Ends November 23rd, but bonus play ends November 2nd. Monopoly is a registered trademark of Hasbro. Copyright McDonald's.
A jury note read, a possible reason or motive for Robert Boutflower's statement about Jeremy being able to kill his own parents. So that's going through the minds of some jurors. We get to October the 28th, 1986. Jeremy Bamber was found guilty. And he was convicted of 5 counts of murder with a 10-2 majority. So 2 people didn't believe it. He was sentenced to life in prison with a minimum of 25 years. I would say that he didn't display much of a reaction. He did slump slightly in his seat, according to sources. The judge, Justice Drake, he described Jeremy as evil, almost beyond belief, which you would expect for somebody who killed 5 people in their family, particularly 2 6-year-old children. He said that he believed he had carried out the murders partly out of greed, because although he was a well-off young man, he was impatient for more money, and that he wanted to be the master of his own life and to enjoy an inheritance that, most of which, he would have eventually received anyway. Justice Drake described Jeremy as having a warped, callous, an evil mind concealed behind an outwardly presentable, civilized manner. He said, I find it difficult to foresee whether it will ever be safe to release someone who can shoot 2 little boys as they lie asleep in their beds. Outside the court, Robert Boutflower gave a triumphant speech. He described Sheila as a fun-loving girl and thanked Ainsley for his painstaking and diligent work on the case. For decades, until his death, he would apparently refer to his nephew, Jeremy Bamber, by his prisoner number. So he was very convinced that they had the right man. Bamber was incarcerated alongside some of the most prolific rapists and murderers at Wormwood Scrubs, which is a Victorian prison, whose own warden has actually described it as a, quote, penal dustbin, which doesn't sound too tantalising, does it? In 1989, Jeremy Bamber appealed his sentence. It was dismissed. Then in 1994, the Home Secretary actually upgraded Jeremy's sentence to a whole life order, meaning that he would spend the rest of his life in prison, which, with respect, if he's murdered 5 people, 2 of which are 6-year-olds, he 100% deserves to die in prison. There is no question in my mind about that. If you just do the maths, 25 years would mean 5 years per person he killed, which would be nothing. So absolutely a full life tariff. In fact, when you think about the guilty verdict, I can't understand how 25 years would ever have been seen as enough. Now we get to 2002, Jeremy Bamber is still saying he's innocent. He appeals again for a second time. Once again, he's unsuccessful. Lord Justice Kaye said, we do not doubt the safety of the verdicts. And we have recorded our judgment, the fact that more we examine the detail of the case, the more likely we thought it be that the jury were right. So at this point, Jeremy Bamber apparently, according to sources, described it as a devastating blow. Bear in mind, Jeremy Bamber has literally always maintained that he's innocent. And I will tell you, there are a lot of people who support him. A lot of people out there believe that Sheila is responsible for the deaths. There's actually a Jeremy Bamber campaign for freedom, with supporters arguing that he's been wrongly convicted and that he is an innocent man. Now, one of the theories that would cast doubt, I believe, on Jeremy's convictions is that the silencer was not used in the murders. And there have been some pretty high-level individuals who've looked at this. So David Fowler, who's a chief medical examiner in Maryland, said that in his professional opinion, the abrasions and burn marks were not consistent on the bodies with the rifle having a silencer. Then two further experts agreed with that opinion. Somebody called Lubiza Frajovic and Marcelo Fierro. They were chief medical examiners in Oakland County and Virginia, respectively. So that's three people who said, listen, no silencer were used. The burn marks are consistent with them not being used. Now, if the silencer wasn't used, that would be significant. As the premise that the silencer had been used was a key piece of evidence used to convict Jeremy. And the judge had actually said that the silencer could, quote, on its own lead the jury to believe that Bamba was guilty. So if it wasn't used, big problem. Now, Jeremy Bamba's solicitor, Simon McKay, said the evidence of three senior and respected pathologists and the wounds to Sheila Cafel are consistent with the rifle having been fired without the silencer fitted. And this shakes the safety of Jeremy Bamba's convictions to their core. Now, further support for this theory comes from the chief of burn service at Arizona Burn Center, a guy called Daniel Caruso. He said, the three wounds sustained by Neville Bamba are consistent in size, shape, and diameter with a threaded end of a Model 5.25 and Schutz rifle barrel heated sufficiently to cause injury. Forensic scientist John Manlove also said that the burn could possibly have been caused by the hot muzzle of a firearm without a sound moderator. So a lot of experts thinking that that silencer wasn't there. Now in 2020, so we're coming right up to the modern day now, Jeremy Bamba submitted 29 complaints claiming that the Essex police had acted illegally in handling complaints about their conduct in their investigation. These included allegations that evidence had been destroyed and withheld, misrepresentations had been made, and witness statements had been altered, which is truly terrifying if that's the case. Apparently, no further action was deemed necessary. Now, he's currently waiting for the CCRC, which is the Criminal Cases Review Commission, to decide whether his case should be referred back to the Court of Appeal. I will tell you, the CCRC does not have a good history in giving people a fair chance. You're just going to throw it out there. The CCRC are meant to be kind of there, you know, I don't know, for innocent people who've had horrendous miscarriages of justice play out, but they're not necessarily that good. Sometimes I think the CCRC, the Criminal Cases Review Commission, should be called the Criminal Cases We're Not Going to Listen to You Commission. We're just going to uphold your conviction, even if it's clear that you're innocent. I'm throwing it out there. They haven't got a good track record. Look them up. But they're meant to see whether, indeed, his case should be referred back to the Court of Appeal. Now, bear in mind, Colin Cafel lost his two sons. It's horrific. He actually went on to work in bereavement psychotherapy. What a hero. And he went on to write the book In Search of the Rainbow's End, Inside the White House Farm Murders in 1994. He called it A Father's Story. In this book, he wrote about his sons, because I think that we have to bring them into focus. He said that they were both creative. They were outgoing. They were sensitive in different ways. He described Nicholas. He said he was enchanted with nature, fascinated with flowers, birds, and butterflies. Nicholas's paintings were bright and colourful, and his expression of love was for the world outside of himself, in things he could see as well as imagine. Daniel, Colin said, was more serious, but equally as loving. His sensitivity was apparently much deeper and inward, more towards people and their feelings, being aware of other people's suffering. His paintings were of homes and families, and when he grew up, he said he wanted to be a mummy. He loved babies. Daniel was also really concerned about being accepted by other boys his age, whereas Nicholas didn't worry himself with those things. Just to say as well, Colin is actually now remarried. He's got a daughter. He works as a sculptor. I think it's a huge strength of character to survive the horror he went through. Now, up until 5 years ago, I fully believed Bamba was 100% guilty. Let me make that clear. In documentaries, I've said, stating that he's likely a narcissist, because I had been entirely fed that narrative. As I've started to research my own cases, I feel that I'm bringing more balance to these perspectives. And I've started to ask myself a serious and essential question. Is there reasonable doubt that Bamba killed his family? So I'm going to share with you some of the new evidence that's come to light so you can make that opinion. Firstly, Bamba has been assessed. In 2009 and after that, he has been assessed to see whether he indeed is a narcissist or has any personality disorder or is indeed a psychopath. And he doesn't. In 2009 in particular, there was a big review of him and he doesn't suffer from any mental illness at all, or indeed narcissistic personality disorder or any personality disorder. Also, when Sheila was alone with the boys, as a single mother struggling with her mental health, she unraveled. She had hallucinations, she had paranoia. She spoke to social services. She said that she might harm her babies. When the twins were four, her family arranged for her to be treated at St. Andrew's Hospital. It's an exclusive facility. It's also where her mother had undergone electroshock therapy. And she genuinely had delusions. She was somebody who was diagnosed with paranoid schizophrenia. And she genuinely thought her sons, apparently, would seduce her. And she saw evil in both of them. Particularly, she saw evil in Nicholas. She thought he was a woman hater. She thought he was a potential murderer. And her gravest concern was that she might actually be capable of killing her boys. But Ferguson in court and in notes basically said this was unlikely. Unlikely. Not something that couldn't happen, just unlikely. He then prescribed her, as I said earlier, antipsychotic medication, discharged her. 5 months before the actual killings, though, she was witnessed in her home with the twins by people who knew her, going into a frenzy. She was beating the walls with her fists. She was saying that people were trying to kill her. And the people who witnessed it said they were just terrified. A friend who was present even told the police that Sheila was behaving like a person possessed and that she claimed to hear the voice of God. So again, that's very scary. Now, on one occasion, she was left alone with a 13-year-old cousin. Sheila apparently offered the girl drugs. She talked about wanting to harm herself. She told her she was a witch. She said that all people are bad. Lots of people heard her talk about this information. And when she went for her final injection of her antipsychotic medication, haloperidol, she actually convinced the doctor to just give her half a dose, which is worrying when she has such serious complications and such serious delusions. Now, like I said, Jeremy Bamba, since he has been in prison, has had lots of psychiatric assessments. His most recent assessment, as I said, in 2009, apparently it placed him in the low normal range for impression management. That means he's not particularly skilled at influencing the way other people perceive him, so not very manipulative, which would make sense because after the apparent killings he was involved in, he went off and did things that if you were trying to be manipulative, you wouldn't do because it would make you look guilty to some degree or less positive in the eyes of others. So not very manipulative. So it is quite hard to sustain the view that he is this person who's so incredibly deceptive, but in front of all of these experts, he basically doesn't seem to have any of the things that would make him that kind of person. In fact, this is the quote. It is hard to sustain the view that Jeremy Bamba is so expert in deceptive self-presentation as to maintain this front over a variety of different assessors, different assessment instruments, and different times. That's what the psychiatrist concluded. Also, one of the things that I've really rethought since doing this research is I always thought it was really incriminating that Neville, who's this big guy, had basically been overpowered. The idea that Sheila, this slight woman, would be able to be violent and overpowering towards this big man didn't make sense. Don't get me wrong, my father had psychosis, and when he had psychosis, he almost became superhuman with his strength. He really did. So that does happen. But even so, I couldn't see that Sheila could have overpowered her father. But I hadn't thought about the fact that he'd already likely been shot four times at this point. So when you think about being shot four times, the blood loss, the horror, the agony, it's probably quite easy to overpower somebody who's already in such a vulnerable state. Also, you have to look at financial gain in a slightly different way as well, which is, yes, he was going to benefit financially, but if he got locked up, then other members of his family would inherit. Because he can't inherit from ill-gotten gains. So, arguably, those people who got together and decided that he was the person who was responsible, well, they had a vested interest in that being the case. Not saying that they were involved, I'm just saying the story that was created, well, you can make sense of why people would want that story to be true if it meant they didn't have the complexities of now one man having access to a lot of money and also to a level of control over their business interests. Now, also, Julie Mugford, bear in mind Jeremy Bamber's ex who said that he was responsible, she also told the court that she hadn't sold her story to try to make herself seem, I don't know, like she actually was a good person. But it turned out she'd actually made £25,000 from selling the story. And it turns out that they hadn't gone for her over those cheque frauds because the bank had agreed not to press charges. I get that, because she'd gone back with a friend and said, look, we took this. I want to be seen as somebody who's dutifully giving the cash back. But when the bank manager was questioned about it, he actually indicated that Detective Stan Jones had accompanied Mugford when she came in to ask for leniency. That seems very strange to me. Now, Colin Caffell as well, Sheila's ex-husband, he actually complained shortly before the trial because he said that one of the statements that he'd given, which was basically a handwritten version of what he'd said, was wrong. Because he said that Bamber had offered him a level of sympathy, saying, I'd had a rough deal all along in respect of Sheila's illness. But when the statement was typed, basically it was changed to suggest that Bamber was saying that he felt he'd been mistreated, as opposed to comforting Caffell. He was being self-engaged and self-caring about his own needs by saying that he was the one who'd been mistreated, which was completely wrong. And Caffell literally wrote to the police saying, you've made a mistake. And he said, you know, it's altered the whole inflection of the sentence, but he was told by the detective, doesn't matter. And then he was told, don't say anything about it in the witness box. He said it'll cause all types of trouble, which is terrifying. Absolutely terrifying. And you know that psychiatrist who gave evidence in court and said that she wouldn't be violent towards her father or kids? Yeah, he wasn't somebody with a great history. Literally, he was working with a teacher who said that he was really scared that he was going to do some horrible things and kill people. And the guy was like, oh, I don't believe that will happen. You just need to get a different teaching post. And that teacher went on to carry out mass murder and literally was quoted as saying after, why didn't you stop me before I did it? I gave you all the warning signs, which does seem a little bit scary. And like I said, a lot of people do challenge his conviction. A guy called Dennis Eady, who's a criminology scholar at Cardiff University, he actually runs one of Britain's innocence projects. And he's quoted as saying that Jeremy Bamber's case was an obvious miscarriage of justice and a singular illustration of the intransigence of the British system. Now, according to an interview in the New Yorker that's just been released, it was released on the 29th of July, 2024, Dennis Eady has said that the CCRC must know that this is an unsafe conviction, to put it mildly. He went on, but they simply do not want to refer it. They've dug so far in the hole, and that's what worries me. That there may be a continuation of the cover-up, because revealing this now is going to be a catastrophe for the criminal justice system. And Heidi Blake, who authors the piece in The New Yorker, is brilliant. It's such a deep dive. I really do suggest you look it up. Also, the journalist who's investigating this situation, they've highlighted that notes were never brought to light that have been now found, such as Bamber initially fearing that the police had killed his family. So on that morning that the group of police went into the farmhouse, he'd got it in his head when he was told that the family had all been killed, that they had done it. And that's actually noted. And it's also noted by a police officer who wrote that down, who also said that Bamber said he didn't believe that his sister was capable of killing the children. So a very different story than what's been told in the press and in the court. And another thing that he says got mixed up where the press are concerned and the court's concerned is that he was seen as this kind of money-desiring individual. He liked money, obviously. He liked the finer things in life. But as opposed to it being him going into the farm and taking things, it was actually family members related to him that immediately started removing items from the farmhouse that were very valuable, and they had no right to do that. And the only reason he'd ever gone and visited an accountant not long after this had started happening was to actually get the farm and contents appraised and to protect himself, because lots of people were taking things from the farm. And also, one of the reasons why he might have seemed a little bit, shall we say, lackluster around things and not acting quite normally, he was doing a huge amount of Valium and alcohol constantly after the murders because he couldn't cope. And that's evidence, you know, doctors did prescribe that. So not the jovial picture that was being painted. Also, officers who were originally involved in the trial, they said that one of the things that really concerned them was when they were looking at the crime scene photographs, things seemed to have changed. So furniture seemed to have been moved and the position of Sheila's body was called into question, and the Bible that was with her, that was placed in a different scenario. And they were like, this shouldn't have happened, and were told, just be quiet. And now this is a direct quote from the New Yorker piece. Detective Inspector Ron Cook, the lead crime scene officer, died several years ago. But when I spoke to his deputy, Deputy Sergeant Neil Davidson, he made a startling revelation. During the examination of the bodies, Cook had lifted the Bible up, had a look at it, and he said it was one of those oh shit moments. Davidson recalled that Cook had stood fumbling with the Bible before asking which page it had been on, and had then put it back by Sheila's body before the pictures were taken to recreate what we just screwed up. This kind of incident had earned Cook a nickname on the force. We called him Bumbling Ron. Davidson said, chaos reigned wherever he trod. Cook oversaw the cleanup of the crime scene, and Davidson helped dispose of bloody carpets and bedding. After Bamber was declared the prime suspect, the shit hit the fan big time. Davidson said, what can we salvage? Who can we blame? Cook spent weeks chasing about, red in the face, trying to find scraps of evidence. Davidson told the interviewer, he was trying to dig himself out of a hole. The whole forensic thing was really a shambles because nothing was preserved. Watching the chaos unfold had left him conflicted about the case. He told the interviewer, I would not be surprised if one day someone comes along and says, here's definitive proof he didn't do it. Like I said, it's a direct quote from the interviewer in the New Yorker, and it is pretty terrifying. Also, I do want to ask a question that I think many of you will have asked yourselves in this case, the silencer. How was that entire farmhouse searched several times by different police officer and never found, but the wider family found it? You know, several officers clarified there was nothing in that cupboard where the silencer was found. Also, the fact that it's been said that the family maybe staged the finding of that silencer, take you back to Barbara Wilson, who's the family secretary. She said, you know, I was convinced that it had been staged so that I could say, yes, I was present. Now, obviously, the wider family say that isn't true. I'm just saying what has been brought forward regarding the questions about this case. Also, there are some concerns. I will tell you that a detective purposely scratched the paintwork on the hearth with the silencer to give the theory that the family had more credibility. This was then presented to the forensics with a piece of tape protecting the flex. Apparently, it hadn't been noticed on prior inspection, but then, hey, these flecks are there. And also, that blood that was a match for Sheila's blood on the silencer, it also matched Robert Boutflower. And he did admit handling the gun and the silencer and that he twisted it quite hard. And so he could have essentially bled on it. And the reason that's quite terrifying is that judge on the case was absolutely specifically instructed it was Sheila's blood. There's no question about it. And that's concerning. Like I said, we're only ever looking for reasonable doubt. It's concerning. And there are notes that have been found by people who were looking into this case. Apparently there are millions of notes, by the way. And this is that the initial police officers who went to White House Farm could literally see someone moving around the farm. Now in court that became, oh, it was tricks of the light, but no. They believed that someone was moving around the farm. Along with that suggestion I talked about earlier, that there were two bodies in the kitchen, Neville's and Sheila's. So how can you see two people in the kitchen and then decide there's only one? It doesn't make any sense. And also in the court, the jury were told that Sheila couldn't handle a gun. Well, she could. She'd been on a 3-day shooting trip with David Boutflower. She'd fired a gun. She'd also attended a shooting party with Peter Eaton. So why did Anne Eaton tell the police there was no way she could use a gun? She could. And it's a discrepancy that needs highlighting. And then another statement that really does bring another discrepancy that's pretty big is the original call logs on the night of the murder. So the police created two separate logs noting that Sheila was wielding a rifle. Now at 3:36 a.m., an officer took down Jeremy Bamber's report that his father had called to say his sister had lost it, that she had a gun, etc. But there was another log created by a dispatcher and given a timestamp 10 minutes earlier, which apparently seemed to relate to a message from Neville himself. that his daughter had actually got hold of one of his guns. Now, the police are absolutely standing by the fact that both logs refer to Bamber's call and that the discrepancy was just a timing error. But you can't say that. It's a log. How can one thing be entered into court saying, well, this is the truth, when there is another thing saying it's an error? It doesn't make any sense, but this is where we are. Now, according to the New Yorker, Bamber's team recently commissioned a review by a document forensics expert, and they concluded that whilst an error was possible, the mismatch was more simply explained if there had been two telephone calls. And also, it appears that Scotland Yard have got logs of a 999 call that was made from White House Farm while Bamber was outside with the police. Now, that's scary. So Heidi Blake, the journalist for The New Yorker, like I said, go and read it, she actually contacted the officer who took that call. So it's an Essex police officer named Nicholas Milbank. Now, Milbank still actually works for Essex Police. He said that call came in at 6:09. He said, from what I can remember, someone phoned 999 from inside the farmhouse. The caller had not spoken to him, but he recalled hearing what might have been muffled speech, perhaps a voice or a radio, and also noises that could have been a door opening and closing or a chair being moved. And he was basically asked, well, could somebody have been alive in the house? And he said, well, obviously. And the interviewer for The New Yorker said, well, what about the statement that was in his name? And he was apparently really taken aback. He said he didn't give a statement. He said, I've never given a statement at all. He said no one inquiring into the crime has ever contacted him. He said no one's ever spoken to him about it since the 1980s, other than the person interviewing him for The New Yorker. So there was a statement issued in his name that he didn't give. And he's also saying that as far as he's concerned, he took that phone call just after 6 a.m. when Jeremy Bamber was stood with the police outside, a call from White House Farm. And another thing that, again, I'm just sharing with you, apparently Neville and June did potentially have a fostering plan for the boys that could have devastated Sheila. The family secretary, again, confirmed that that could have been a motive that could have sent her over the edge. And bear in mind, again, the Bout Flowers, they inherited a lot of money. They got the estate, they got a lot of treasures from the White House. And apparently, one of the things that they got was June's diamond and sapphire engagement ring. And apparently, Jeremy Bamber has been devastated by that because he wanted it cremated with his mother, but it was actually removed from her finger before the autopsy without his knowledge. And that upsets anybody. But it also calls into question this money-grabbing man who actually was quite happy for a very expensive engagement ring to burn with his mother. Now, I think that this is a case that I and you and so many of us are genuinely conflicted about, whether Jeremy Bamber is an evil man who murdered his family, including six-year-old nephews, for money, or was he betrayed? Was he betrayed by a bitter ex-girlfriend? Was he betrayed by his family, who wanted to gain from his conviction? Louis Theroux himself, the amazing, incredible Louis Theroux, he worked on a project involving the White House Farm murders called the Bamber's Murder at the Farm. And Theroux said, there are legitimate people who believe that Jeremy is innocent. He said, across the board, you'll find people who believe there were serious problems with the case in terms of how it was investigated and how it was prosecuted. He said, there are things that are quite hard to explain on both sides. There was no forensic evidence of his presence on the farm, which is kind of extraordinary. And it is kind of extraordinary. And I say that as someone who went on record saying Jeremy Bamber is guilty as hell, he's a narcissist, a psychopath, and he deserves to rot in hell. I said that. I meant it. I'm not so sure I mean it now. Are you? My job is not to say whether Jeremy Bamber is guilty or indeed innocent. My job is to say, is there reasonable doubt? And by God, there's reasonable doubt. I wait with bated breath and interest to see how this will play out. Is he innocent? Has he spent over 40 years of his life in prison because the wheels of justice were deceptive and want to keep him there to protect themselves rather than to act on the truth of this case? Or is he indeed the person who pulled that trigger?
That's it for Bang to Rights today. Join me for the next episode. See you then. Be safe.